The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome all of you to another wonderful evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And by all means, I encourage you to buy the book and have John sign it for you afterwards, because it is full of wonderful stories about unsung heroes in college basketball, both players and coaches. But first, a plug for telling your friends that missed tonight that they can get the podcast from the Free Library of Philadelphia Author Events website, and they can listen to the podcast of this event and other lectures that have taken place here, so that you have an additional source of entertainment that's available through the Free Library of Philadelphia. I would also encourage you to consider making a gift to the Free Library for the enrichment programs. You know, the Free Library has an extensive program to advance the cause of reading in all of the branches that exist in Philadelphia. And so it's a wonderful way to help young people and a wonderful way to support the Free Library. So I encourage you to consider making a gift to the Free Library. Tonight, we are privileged to have John Feinstein with us. John is a graduate of Duke University. He is, I think, a wonderful storyteller. Any of you who've read any of his 42 books that he has written over the course of his career, I'm sure you will find many vignettes that are very enjoyable, because he captures the human emotion that takes place around sporting events and team play. One of the reasons that he's written 42 books, a lot of people don't know unless they have children. He's written a series of young adult books taking sports figures and weaving into a story about sports and mystery. So it's a young adult's way to entertain, and something for you to think about if you have children or grandchildren, in addition to your obvious interest about sports, because you're here tonight to hear a master storyteller talk about this book and other books that you'll have a chance to ask him. He's a great lover of Philadelphia, and he thinks the Palestra is the best place to watch a college basketball game. But he probably mentions at least three or four times in this book that there's a plaque at the Palestra that you'll find when you go just inside the Palestra. I believe it's on the right, but you can ask him if I'm unsure. You'll find out in the book. And the plaque says, "To win the game is great. To play the game is greater. But to love the game is the greatest of all." So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Feinstein to the Philadelphia Library.
Thank you, Morris. It's great to be back at the Free Library. I did get a tour of the entire city tonight, because I made the mistake of using Google Maps, even though I'd been here before. And when I saw the sign that said Ohio 5, I realized the directions weren't all that good. So I'm really glad to be back here. In fact, getting invited back is kind of cool. The last time I was invited back someplace with this much enthusiasm was when my ex-wife's lawyer suggested I return to his office to give another deposition. So this is a lot more pleasant. As Morris mentioned, this is my 42nd book. I wrote Season on the Brink when I was 9. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it anyway. Hard to believe that was more than 33 years ago. But this book was, in many ways, a return to my roots, because I started out at the Washington Post as the night police reporter, believe it or not. But even during that period when I was on the Metro staff, I would moonlight covering college hoops. I went to an ACC school. By the way, the 4 years I was at Duke, true story, Duke finished last, tied for last, and last in the ACC. When we talked about going to the Final Four, we were talking about the semis of the ACC tournament. And this is when it was a 7-team league, not a 32-team league like it is now. And in fact, the year after I graduated, Duke went to the real Final Four. Gene Banks, from right here in West Philadelphia, was on that team as a freshman. Kenny Denard, Mike Jaminski, Jim Spanarkel. Bill Foster was the coach. And Bill had a very dry sense of humor. And after the Friday practice in St. Louis, which is where the Final Four was that year, he did the usual press conference. And somebody said, "Coach, a year ago you were last in the ACC, and now here you are in the Final Four. What changed?" The obvious answer was Banks and Denard. But he said, "Well, John Feinstein graduated." And people are looking around the room going, "Who the hell is John Feinstein, and what did he do to that team?" So that was my introduction to the Final Four. And in those days, as I write in the introduction to Backroads, the Saturday games started at 2:30 Eastern time. And the second, because in those days you could play a college basketball game in under 3 hours, the second game would be over in plenty of time to go to dinner. Now the first game starts at 6:10 Eastern time, if you're lucky. And between at that Final Four, there were 6 TV timeouts per game, 90 seconds each, 15-minute halftime. Now we have 10 TV timeouts per game, 3 minutes each, and a 22-minute halftime. And a kind of a little interesting story about the NCAA, who, if any of you have read me, you know just how much I like them. The reason they initially went to the 20-minute halftime was in 2003, when the second war in Iraq, started the night before the tournament. And CBS said, "Could we please have an extra 5 minutes at each halftime so we can update people on what's going on with the war?" And that was a reasonable request, and the NCAA complied. Except the war ended. The 20-minute timeouts have never ended. And I was in a meeting a few years ago as an ex-president of the U.S. Basketball Writers with the NCAA Basketball Committee, another group I'm big fans of. And I said, "Okay, guys, the war's over. Why do we still have 20-minute timeouts?" And of course, knowing the answer, more commercials. And one of the NCAA guys said, "Well, it's because, you know, when we play in the domes, it takes extra time for the players to get to the locker room." Seriously? It might take an extra 15 seconds, 20. I mean, I can walk to those locker rooms pretty fast, and I'm not in as good shape as the players are. So that's the NCAA. The good thing about the NCAA is they're only lying when their lips are moving. So what I wanted to do in doing this book was get away from all that. Get away from games played in football stadiums. I went to the Final Four, but the book wasn't about that. The book was about players and coaches and teams who aren't on ESPN every night, who will never have Dick Vitale screaming about diaper dandies, thank God, but who love the game and play the game and coach the game with as much intensity as Mike Krzyzewski or Roy Williams or Bill Self or John Calipari or anybody you want, any of those big name coaches you want to name. When I started watching basketball, college basketball, growing up in New York, I was a fan of the following teams: Manhattan, NYU, and Columbia, and Army. Throw in Army. Bob Knight was the coach. In fact, the very first college basketball game I ever saw in person was the consolation game of the 1965 NIT between Army and NYU. This is back when the NIT mattered. And the assistant coach sitting on the Army bench was Bob Knight. Little did either one of us know at that moment. Little did he know, looking across the court at 8-year-old Johnny Feinstein, that he would become a part of his life later. But I wanted to go back and write about teams, go to places where you're not hit by corporate screaming advertisements the minute you walk in the door. And Morris mentioned the Palestra. And my wife often says that if I ever disappear, she'll send the police to look for me in the Palestra because she will assume that's where I've moved. You're Philadelphians, so you get it. When I say to people, there's no place like the Palestra for a basketball game, they go, what, the Palestra? Yes, the Palestra. And it is a damn shame that all the Big Five games are no longer played there. They should all be played there. Yeah, thank you. I said that a couple years ago, and the Villanova people went crazy. Because their building's so great, right? I mean, seriously? And Morris mentioned the sign. Every time, I could show you pictures on my phone right now of me standing in front of the sign. Because every time I come in the building, that's what, it's my pilgrimage. I walk in, I go to the right, I go to the sign, I touch it. And I have some poor person walking by, can you take my picture, please? And then I read it again. To win the game is great, to play the game is greater, but the greatest thing of all is to love the game. How cool is that? And it's so simple, and it says everything you want sports to be. Then I'll go buy three pretzels, only one for me. The other two are for the two men I dedicated this book to. Jack Shore, who has covered Philadelphia sports for the AP for 45 years, but perhaps more important, is the leading scorer in the history of the Palestra, because he organized the noon hoops game for sports writers on Wednesdays for about 40 years. And Jack was a Division III player, so he could play a little bit. And he likes to introduce himself as the leading scorer in Palestra history. But perhaps more important than that, because he was in charge of those games, he has a key to the back of the Palestra, the back door. And he pulls up right to the back door, and one night he's getting out snowing, and the guard says, hey, buddy, you can't go in there. The door's locked. And Jack says, yeah, I know, I've got a key. And the guy goes, yeah, right, you have a key, sure. So Jack opens the door, waves at the guy, and walks inside. How cool a moment would that be? Nobody's ever I'm lucky I have a key to my house. And the other person I dedicated the book to is Dick Weiss. How many of you remember Dick Hoops Weiss? Oh, good. A legend here in Philadelphia, as he will certainly tell you. But Hoops and I were actually in the Villanova Victory Parade in 1985. We were covering the Final Four in Lexington, and Villanova beats Georgetown in one of the more unlikely upsets in championship history. And I had actually covered Villanova the entire way because I was sent with Maryland to cover the Dayton sub-regional, Maryland and Navy. David Robinson was playing for Navy. Villanova was there as an eighth seed playing at Dayton in the first round. It shows you how much the committee thought of them. And they won that game by one. Then they upset Michigan in the second round. Now they're in the Sweet 16. And they're at the same site in Birmingham with Maryland. So I came up to Philadelphia, wrote a couple stories about Villanova. Villanova beats North Carolina in the regional final, so they're in the Final Four. I come back up to Philadelphia. By now, Rolly and I are best friends. Even though he always liked to say to me, you know, you don't have to be Jewish to be a schmuck. And I would say, and you're living proof of that, Rolly. But they beat Georgetown in the championship game. And I'm in the locker room, and Rolly says to me, you're coming back with us on the plane tomorrow morning. You're coming. Well, it's a great story. Of course I am. I said, Rolly, you got to take Hoops, right? And he goes, yeah, tell Hoops to come too. So we fly on the plane, left at 7 in the morning. We got about 2 hours sleep. And when we got off the plane, they loaded us on flatbed trucks to ride into City Hall. Now, here's the difference between Hoops and me. I hid behind Eddie Pinckney. He's waving to the fans. And for years after that, now Jay Wright can confirm this, Hoops, every time that 85 championship came up, Hoops would say, ha ha, you know, tell him who got you on the plane, okay? And I go, yeah, fine, Hoops. So I was sitting with Jay at a summer camp a few years back, and Hoops comes walking along, and I said, we were talking about the fact that it was the 20th anniversary of the 85 championship, and Villanova was finally getting Rolly to come back. Because you remember when Rolly left, there were a lot of hard feelings. And Jay, who of course coached under Rolly, said, Coach, you got to come back for the 20th anniversary, and Rolly agreed to do it. And so I said, watch this. I'm going to bring up 85, and Hoops is going to say he got me on the plane. So Hoops comes walking over, and I say, hey, we're just talking about the 20th anniversary of the 85 championship, and Hoops goes, oh, who got you on the plane? Jay literally fell off the bleacher. He was laughing so hard. So finally, in 2016, we're at the Final Four in Houston. Hoops is one of my dear friends. That's why I co-dedicated the book to him, and he knows basketball better than just about anybody on the planet, and that's why his name is Hoops. And we're driving in a car back from the practices on Friday, and we'd been talking to Jay. Of course, that's the year Villanova won with the buzzer beater over North Carolina, and talking about what a good guy Jay is, and Hoops says, oh, who got you on the plane in 85? And I slammed my hand on the wheel, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I can't. I got you on the plane, goddammit. And he goes, really? That's not the way I remember. And I go, I know that. So, but I wanted to do Back Roads because of moments like Villanova 85, back when basketball was still, for me as a reporter, intimate, that I could have those kind of relationships with players and coaches. And, you know, in fact, Mike Krzyzewski is not part of this book, and Morris pointed out to me that I left him out of the acknowledgments, which I'm sure will destroy his year. But in 1983, people may forget that after 3 years at Duke, Mike Krzyzewski was 38-47. And everybody, all the Duke people, wanted him fired. And they lose in the ACC tournament to Virginia, 109-66. And I'm sitting watching the last game of that night with a good friend of mine, Keith Drum, who was also close to Krzyzewski. And Bobby Dwyer, who was Mike's top assistant at the time, comes back into the Omni and says, you guys have got to come out to the hotel when this game's over. Why? Well, Mickey's in the room crying because she thinks they're going to get fired. The alumni are all over Tom Butters, the AD, saying, you got to fire this guy. And Mike wants to kill somebody. So we get in a car about 1 o'clock in the morning. We drive to the perimeter of Atlanta where Duke is staying. We get in a, we pick Mike up, and we go to a Denny's. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Some of you may have heard or read this story. I apologize if you have. But we go to a Denny's, and it's Mike, it's Tom Mickle, who was the sports information director, Bobby Dwyer, Keith Drum, and myself. And they bring us water. And Tom Mickle raises his glass and he says, here's to forgetting tonight. And Krzyzewski raises his glass and he goes, here's to never blanking forgetting tonight. They won the next 16 games they played against Virginia. But more important to me, he never forgot that night. And who was there? In 1991, when they won the national championship, I walked out on the court and I put my hand out and I said, hey, congratulations, I'm really happy for you. And he pulled me in and he said, come a long way from the blank and Denny's, haven't we? And 20 years after that, I was writing a book called One-on-One, which was basically me kind of recounting my first 25 years of writing books. It was right after I turned 30. And I called Mike and I said, look, you're going to go past Dean Smith on the all-time wins list when you play at UNC Greensboro. I thought that was a pretty good lock win. And I want to come down, spend some time with you, because to go from where you were after those first 3 years to where you are is extraordinary. And he said, yeah, come on down. Bus leaves at 2:30. Meet me in my office. Well, you can sit with me on the bus. We can talk then. And then when we get there, we can talk in the locker room for a while. Great. So I come down and I go out to lunch with a guy named Mike Craig, who's now the AD at St. John's, who was Mike's kind of man Friday back then. He was his fundraiser. And if you ever saw Mike walking off a court back in those days, Mike Craig was one step behind and Kevin White, the AD, was on the other side. And so I went to lunch with Mike Craig and he says, so when are you going to talk to Coach K? And I said, on the bus going to Greensboro. And he says, you came all the way down here to talk to him on a cell phone? I said, no, I came all the way down here to talk to him from the next seat. And he starts shaking his head vehemently. And he says, that's impossible. Nobody who's not part of the team rides that bus. I don't ride that bus. And I said, well, tell me what I misunderstood. And I walk him through it. And he shakes his head again, and he says, why would he let you do that? why would he let you do that? And I said, because I was in the blank in Denny's. And that's really true. That's the kind of guy Mike Krzyzewski is. That's totally off the book, and I apologize, although I will tell you one quick story from the book that involves Mike Krzyzewski. I went with Army when they played at Duke, because for kids like that, who are never going to play in the NBA, obviously, to play in Cameron is a big deal. And I was in the locker room with the team and the coaches before the game, and at Duke, when the visitors come out of the locker room, they have to cross the Duke bench, and Krzyzewski will stand there and shake hands with the coaches. And so I walk out with the coaches, and Mike looks at me and he goes, what the blank are you doing here? I have to clean up a lot when Mike's involved. And I said, I gave the pregame talk. And so he kind of laughs a little bit. And halftime, Duke's only up 6. And Mike had to call timeout because a little guard named Tommy Funk on back-to-back plays stripped Zion Williamson and R.J. Barrett. You know, future NBA multimillionaires humiliated by future Army second lieutenant. And Krzyzewski had to call timeout, and he was not happy. So as the teams are crossing, at halftime, I looked at Mike. I said, I guess I did a pretty good job, huh? He didn't even crack a smile. Wasn't happy. So the story that sums up the experience I had doing this book takes place at Longwood University. Raise your hand if you can tell me where Longwood University is. You're close. You get points. Farmville, Virginia. But you're excused, because the coach at Longwood now is a guy named Griff Aldrich. Griff Aldrich played Division III ball at Hampton, Sydney, and one of his teammates was Ryan Odom. Now, I'm assuming most of you know who Ryan Odom is. He's coach at UMBC that beat Virginia 2 years ago, first 16 seed to beat a 1 seed. And after college, Griff Aldrich went to law school, graduated, wanted to be a basketball coach, but he had $100,000 in student loans to repay. So he got a job as a lawyer in a Houston law firm and was hugely successful. He's making about $800,000 a year. And at the age of 42, Ryan gets the UMBC job, and Griff says, you know what? I want to coach. He calls Ryan and says, I want to coach. And Ryan says, well, I can hire you as my director of basketball operations. It pays $32,000 a year. So he leaves the $800,000 a year job, moves his wife and 3 children from Houston to Baltimore, and 2 years later, they upset Virginia in the first round, first time a 16 seed had ever won a game. And the president of Longwood was a graduate of Virginia Law School and had been there 1 year after Griff. And he's looking for a coach. He hires Griff, which gets his income up to $150,000 a year. So he's going in the right direction at least. And I went down to spend a day with him, and they were playing High Point. Tubby Smith is now the coach at High Point. Former coach at Kentucky and many other places, won a national championship. And the afternoon of the game, Griff and I are having coffee, and he says, what a coaching matchup. Tubby, 606 wins in a national championship, me, 12 wins. My players better be a lot better than his. So that night during the game, I get a text from my wife, and it says, I forget where you are tonight. When will you be home? So I texted back and said, I'm in Farmville, Virginia. I'll be home about midnight. She texts right back and says, you are having an affair. There's no such place as Farmville, Virginia. So the title of that chapter is, Yes, Christine, There Is a Farmville. And I had experiences, not quite like that one, but experiences with these types of teams, players, and coaches, often in places that many people haven't heard of. One of my other great experiences was right here in Philadelphia. Not a surprise. And it was in the Palestra. Not a surprise. There was a doubleheader, of course a split doubleheader, because these days nobody gives you 2-for-1 on anything, except maybe, you know, McNuggets. But the first game at 1 o'clock was Drexel Temple. The second game was Loyola Chicago, coming off the Final Four, playing St. Joseph's. And it was at 5 o'clock. And it was Drexel's home game. And Zach Spiker, who's the coach at Drexel and who understands things like this, scheduled the game in the Palestra rather than in the DAC. I'm sure many of you have been to the DAC if you're Hoops fans, because he knew it would be Fran Dunphy's last chance to coach in the Palestra. And as you guys know, Fran was the coach at Penn for 17 years and then coached at Temple for 13 years. And So when they introduce the teams, normally, of course, you introduce the visiting coach and then you introduce the home coach. Well, they did it the other way around. They introduced Zach, and then the PA announcer, the Drexel PA announcer, said, "And please welcome coaching his final game in the Palestra, winner of 500 and I think at that point 71 games, Mr. Big Five, Fran Dunphy." And everybody in the building stood and they started clapping, and they clapped and they clapped, and Dunph is going, "Okay, thank you, please stop." And they won't stop. Went on for 5 minutes and 10 seconds. I timed it, and that's an important part of the story. Temple won the game, and as Dunph was getting ready to leave, Porter Moser, the coach at Loyola, was coming in, and they stopped and chatted like coaches will do. And I walked over and I said to Porter, I said, "Did Dunph tell you about the ovation?" And Dunph's waving me off, you know. And he says, no, what about it?" And I said, five minutes. And Dunph goes, "Oh, he's exaggerating, Porter. And I said, "I timed it." And Dunph went, "Oh, God, you're such a pain in the neck." But that's because he's that way. He came to dinner tonight just because he's my friend. And he still teaches a class at Temple. And one of the class guys in the history of college basketball, at least in my lifetime. And Temple is poorer for not having him as their coach, just as St. Joseph's is poorer for not having Phil Martelli as their coach. I mean, that was a huge loss to Big Five basketball. When those two guys, Fran coached his last game in the NCAA tournament the same day Phil got fired at St. Joe's. And to show you the kind of guys they are, when Dunph heard about it, he's getting ready to play an NCAA tournament game, he immediately calls Phil and says, "Why didn't you call me?" And Phil said, "Well, you have a game tonight. I didn't want to bother you." He says, "Come on." And after the game, Temple lost that night to Belmont, so it was Fran's last game. And I said to him, "Are you okay?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm okay." He said, "But I'm so upset about what happened to Phil." And those two guys have raised so much money for Coaches Versus Cancer and in this city. And one of the great challenges that their successors will have is it will be, forget wins and losses, we'll be picking that mantle up. So that was a special day for me. And I spent time with both Loyola of Chicago, which had their great run to the Final Four in 28, led by Sister Jean, who, by the way, turned 100 recently and is still going strong. And also with UMBC, the year after their moment in the spotlight. That's kind of where I came up with the title, The Back Roads to March, because every year in March, somebody emerges who nobody's expecting to become a star. Not a star in the way the team that wins the national championship is, although Butler came pretty damn close in 2010, but a star in that they'll upset a glamour team or two, or in the case of Loyola, four, and make the tournament special that way. George Mason did it, VCU did it, Butler did it twice, Loyola's done it. Those are the best stories. You know, so, I mean, look, I'll never root against Mike Krzyzewski, but Duke wins another national championship, fine, great. But is it a great story? I don't think so. Same with all the other power schools. But when UMBC does what it did, when Loyola does what it did, it's something we treasure. And there are so many moments like that. How many of you saw the Vermont kid the other night? So I'll tell the story. A young man from Vermont was in a car accident as a freshman. He was a big recruit for Vermont. And he was injured so badly he could never play basketball again. On senior night, they dressed him. They started him. And through an agreement between the two coaches, John Becker and Will Brown, Albany scored the first basket. Vermont didn't guard him. Vermont comes down. They pass the ball to the young man. He makes a layup. They stop the game. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. Go look it up on YouTube. Just look up Vermont player scores basket. And it was great. The refs are applauding. Will Brown, the Albany coach, is out there hugging him. Those are the moments that make sports. To me, I mean, you see teams win games, lose games. Somebody wins a Super Bowl. Somebody cheats to win the World Series. I mean, come on. It happens all the time, right? By the way, I think President Trump just pardoned the Astros. Either that or he's putting Mike Pence in charge of the investigation, you know? Which certainly fills us all with great confidence. I want to tell you about another kid who's a part of this book, even though he didn't play a game last year or this year. His name is Seth Towns. He's from Columbus, Ohio, grew up in the inner city. His best friend was killed in a drive-by shooting. Another good friend was killed in a home invasion. But Seth's mother was a teacher, and she made sure he and his younger brother both got through school in very good shape academically. And Seth's a really good basketball player. You might see him in the NBA in a couple years, but I'll get to that in a sec. So he's being recruited by Ohio State, by Michigan, by Virginia, by Kansas. All the big teams are recruiting him. 6'7", he can handle, he can shoot. And he's also being recruited by Harvard. Now, Harvard is coached by Tommy Amaker, who I've known since he was a junior in high school outside Washington, D.C., W.T. Woodson High School. And Tommy Tommy will tell you that every once in a while there's a player who's good enough to play for the big time teams, but might just think going to Harvard's a good idea. And so he started recruiting Seth Towns. And he finally went on a home visit. He had scheduled 3 different home visits, had to be canceled because he couldn't get out of Boston. It was the winter when it snowed every day. And he finally gets to Columbus, and he's in the living room, and he's talking to Seth and his mom. And he's thinking, I have to make my point. And Tommy's one of those guys. If he's standing up here, you'd think he represents Harvard just the way Harvard should be represented, the way you would imagine Harvard would be represented. And his wife's a psychologist. She's on the faculty at Harvard. I mean, you know, that kind of family. And he looks at Seth's mom, and he looks at Seth, and he goes, "Look, I just want to tell you one thing." And he points at Seth, and he goes, "If you don't go to Harvard, you're out of your blanking mind." And he thought, for a minute, he thought he'd blown it because the look came across the mother's face. And then later she told him she thought that was great. That was just the thing to say. So Seth called him a few weeks later and said, "Coach, I want you to know I'm not out of my blanking mind. I'm coming to Harvard." As a sophomore, he was the Ivy League player of the year. And that's how good a player he is. But in the Ivy League championship game, right here in the Palestra, one of the few bad moments ever in the Palestra, he tore his knee up. And he's had to have 3 surgeries. He has not played since. He's the captain of the Harvard team this year, even though he's not playing. Next year, he's going to graduate in the spring, and he'll go play at a big-time school next year because he still has 2 years of eligibility left. And the day he announced, because he can't play, he can't stay at Harvard. Harvard has one of those crazy rules that you can only play sports over an 8-semester period. And once the 9th semester starts, you're no longer eligible, no matter what the NCAA rules say, no matter what the Ivy League rules say, for that matter. So if he wants to play basketball, he has to go somewhere else. He said the day he announced that he was going to try to play again next year, because his knee is now recovering, finally, he had calls from 70 schools, 68 of them big-time schools. So that's how good a player people think of him. But when I interviewed Seth, he said to me at one point, a quote I like to use comes from another Harvard graduate named Ralph Waldo Emerson, class of 1821. And there are many quotable Emerson lines, as you all know. But Seth quotes this: "Do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a mark." Leave a trail, excuse me. See, I can't even quote it right. I'm going to be honest with you. I've done this a long time. He's the first kid who ever quoted Emerson to me. And I'd throw in the coaches with that. The only other time anybody ever quoted Emerson to me was when tennis players talked about Roy Emerson. And another special kid I dealt with, Paul Rowley, not a great player. 6th man at William & Mary last year as a second-year law student. He graduated in 3 years. He had a redshirt year because he'd been injured. And he told the coach, Tony Shaver, "Well, I'd like to keep playing while I can, but I'd like to go to law school too." Now, Rowley was an important part of the team, and Tony Shaver's initial reaction was, "I don't know if you can handle law school in Division I basketball, Paul." And he said, No, I can do it, coach." So he only had a 3.76 GPA his first year in law school, 3.87 his second year in law school. And Tony Shaver said there was only one thing that bothered him, coaching Paul Rowley, was the fact that he always whistled during practice because he was having such a good time. He loved playing basketball so much. And he said, "Paul, can you stop whistling? Coach, am I whistling? Really? I didn't know that." So he's now a third-year law student. He's no longer playing. He's out of eligibility. But he's a third-year law student, and I'm hoping that he will adopt my children at some point. So, because he's going to be a lot richer than I ever was. I'm rambling here, but I always try to tell this story when I speak. I spent some time with Iona. Tim Kloos is the coach. He's sick, actually. But Tim took Iona to four straight NCAA tournaments. And anybody know who the most famous coach in the history of Iona is? Jim Valvano, exactly right. And Jim, when he first got the job at Iona, he'd been the coach at Bucknell, was at a party. There you go. Why are you here? Your guys are playing tonight. You got a score? 7 o'clock game. I only know that because all the Patriot League games started at 7 o'clock tonight. But, Bucknell's up by one on the road. Could pull an upset. They're playing American. So Valvano's at a party right after he gets the job. And he's so happy. He's introducing himself to people. "Hi, I'm Jim Valvano. Iona College. Hi, I'm Jim Valvano. Iona College." Finally, a woman walks up to him and says, "Aren't you awfully young to own your own college?" My favorite Jim story involves a referee named Hank Nichols, Philadelphia guy. You probably know him, right? Hank's in the Basketball Hall of Fame, deservedly so. And one thing I loved about Hank is Dean Smith invented most of basketball. And one of the things he invented was the charge. You know, and he would have his players running all over the court, standing in front of people and falling down. And whenever Carolina player would do that, Hank would look at him and say, "Get up, son," and would never call the charge. It made Dean crazy. Hank is running down the court one night and hears Valvano calling his name. And he turns around and he says, "Jimmy, what is it?" He says, "Hank, can you tee me up for what I'm thinking?" "Well, no, Jimmy, I can't tee you up for what you're thinking." "Good. In that case, I think you suck." He said it was such a good line that he couldn't tee him up. So as you can tell, I was all, oh, one other coach I have to mention. Jim Calhoun, who is now coaching Division III University of St. Joseph's, not St. Joseph's University here in Philadelphia, University of St. Joseph's in West Hartford, Connecticut, Division III. They're in the D3 tournament. 26-2 this year. Last year was the first year they ever had male students in the school. It was an all-women's school until last year. And the athletic director called Jim 3 years ago now and said, "We're going to have a men's team. You got any ideas who we should get to coach?" And Jim said, "Yeah, me." Because he'd been out of coaching for 6 years at that point, and he missed it. I mean, coaches coach. I mean, I'm going to go play golf. No. That's why Krzyzewski doesn't retire. Because he doesn't play golf. So he gets hired to coach the University of St. Joseph's. And I went and spent a day with him. And I swear to God, he was crazier in the game I watched than in any Final Four game he ever coached. He's screaming at the refs. He's throwing water bottles. If not for the fact that the three refs combined were younger than he is, he'd have been thrown out before halftime. And the intensity and the love of doing what he was doing was so much fun to see. Jim was always intense. In fact, he and Gary Williams, let's say, to put it mildly, did not get along, particularly when Jim was at UConn and Gary was at Boston College. And in one game, Gary literally will forget what he said during a game. He will say the worst things in the world, and then after the game, he'll say, "Why did you say that?" One game, he had a very good player named Obina Ikhizi, who had a 3.7 GPA in engineering. I mean, he's a brilliant kid. and they're playing Wake Forest, and Obina Akizi's trying to guard Tim Duncan, and it's not going very well. And Gary, during a timeout, says, "You know what your problem is? You know what your problem is? You spent too damn much time studying." And after the game, I said, "Gary, how can you say that to the kid?" He said, "What? What?" And I told him, and he said, "I didn't say that. You're crazy." I said, "I was from here to here when you said it." And he said, "Well, I shouldn't have said that." But during a Boston College Connecticut game, Gary called Jim a name that you really aren't supposed to call people. And when the game ended and they went and shook hands, Jim looked at him and said, "I'm just going to tell you this right now. You ever call me that again, you're going down. I don't care what the circumstances are, who, where we're playing, you're going down." And Gary goes, "What?" And he says, "You can't call me a blank." And Gary goes, "I would never call another coach that." "Oh, you're out of your mind." And they started arguing all over again because Jim was insulted and Gary was insulted. Jim was insulted by the name, and Gary was insulted that Jim thought he called him the name. So a little bit of intensity there. I've always said that Gary Williams and I have been friends for 35 years, which means he hates me a little less than he hates most people. Turned 75 yesterday, by the way, which is remarkable. He looks 50. So I'm looking for Andy. I just wanted to be sure before I get to Q&A. One of the things people ask me often about how I feel about the NCAA basketball committee, and I get into that a lot in this book, because these are teams that if they don't win their conference title, they're not getting in the NCAAs. And I would point out to you, as I have to them, that if Loyola had not won the Missouri Valley Conference tournament 2 years ago, they wouldn't have been in the tournament. They were an 11th seed. They would not have gotten an at-large bid. And the problem is, in the old days, athletic directors and commissioners were often ex-coaches. Dave Gavitt was on the committee. Terry Holland was on the committee. Vic Bubas was on the committee. Guys who really knew basketball. Now, athletic directors are no longer ex-coaches. They're business school graduates. And they know about business. They know about fundraising. But they don't know squat about basketball. And they sit around with all their computer printouts and go, "Well, let's see. Stephen F. Austin's net is 89. Oh, they can't be in the tournament unless they win their conference tournament." Ask Mike Krzyzewski if he thinks they should be in the tournament. And these are good teams, as they prove every year. The ones that do get a chance, usually by winning a conference tournament. Is there anybody in here who can name for me the one school that right now has not lost a game in conference play this season? Good guess, but they lost one. Dayton, you're right. Dayton, there's two. Thank you for getting that. Dayton is right, but the one you don't know is New Mexico State. And New Mexico State last year, you might remember, lost to Auburn in the first round, 78-77. How'd Auburn end up doing? They came within one questionable call of playing in the national championship game. So my point is they don't know basketball. They know how to read computer printouts. And so frequently, and remember, the balance is always tipped against the mid-majors. Stephen F. Austin right now has 7 unscheduled games for next year. You know why? Nobody wants to play him. Why would you play him? When Steve Lapis was here at Villanova, one year he was supposed to play Delaware. He called Mike Bray, who was then the coach at Delaware. He said, "I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to give you a line about scheduling. I'm not playing you. You're too good." They had a contract. And he said, "If I win, nobody gives me credit. If I lose, I get killed. So we're just not playing." Bray understood. And that because that's the way the sport is. And the balance is always tipped in favor. When I hear a team that's in ninth place in the ACC or the Big Ten say, "Oh, we deserve a bid," I shut up. You've got every possible advantage, and you can't finish 500 in your conference? Go play in the NIT. Or the CIT, or the CBI, or whatever the heck those tournaments are called. But let me finish with this before I take questions. College basketball is the greatest sport there is. I love it. And the palestra to me is symbolic of all that's good in college basketball. I know I'm a little naive. Nothing is perfect, but this was a joyride for me. I went back to my roots as a reporter. I went back to my roots as a college basketball fan. And that night at Longwood summed up in many ways what it was all about for me. And I really enjoyed going to games every night in a place where you could sit up close. Mark Turgeon, the Maryland coach, asked me, why don't you come to more of our games? And I said, because I can't see. The media seats are obstructed view. And he said to me, well, what if I got you a ticket behind our bench? I said, you think I want to sit with your fans? I'd rather stay home. Believe me, Maryland fans are as bad as it gets. And Maryland people will tell you that, not just me. But the day that summed up what's cool about college basketball for me was Martin Luther King Day. And that day, Harvard played at Howard. Howard is a great school academically, but they struggle athletically in every sport. But it was a sellout, 2,700 seats, Burr Gym, which was built the same year that Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. By the way, anybody know where the notes are for the I Have a Dream speech? George Raveling, exactly, from right here in Philadelphia, Villanova grad. He was asked to be a bodyguard that day, along with several friends, and he was standing right here as Dr. King spoke. And when Dr. King left the podium, he left his notes. And George picked him up and walked after him and said, Dr. King, you want your notes? He said, nah, you can keep them. They're probably worth about $3 million right now. But Howard is playing Harvard. They played the national anthem, and they also played the black national anthem. And the players from both teams stood together, fists in the air, during the anthem. And I'm not one who gets chills during the national anthem, especially when people take 3 minutes to sing it. The song's meant to be played fast. My dad told me that when I was a kid. He knew something about music. But during that period when they played those two songs, I had chills. And I said, this is the place to be on Martin Luther King Day. It was a great game. It was a great atmosphere and really good kids on both teams. And that's what this year was for me. It was that day at Howard. It was that night at Longwood. It was being with Army when they scared the hell out of Duke for a half. In fact, Jimmy Allen said that he made one mistake in that game because Army scored first. And it was 2-0, and he said, I should have called timeout and gotten a picture of the scoreboard. And I really wish he had. So thank you all very much for having me back again. And we've got folks with microphones. We have two mics, one in each aisle. So come on down if you have a question, or just stand up and shout. My ears are pretty good. But preferable to use a mic.
Can you talk about the impact of the one-and-doners?
Well, part of the impact of the one-and-done is that we see more upsets from mid-major teams in the NCAA tournament. By the way, if you ever want to get punched in the mouth, tell Mark Few that Gonzaga is a mid-major. You're guaranteed you'll be down in about 5 seconds. But because they have juniors and seniors, and a lot of them have chips on their shoulder because they weren't recruited by the big-time teams, and this is their chance to prove themselves. Overall, it's been a disaster for all of basketball because the kids who are only in college for a year aren't going to really listen to their coaches because, hey, man, I'm going to the NBA. I don't need to listen to coach. And so they get to the NBA. They don't know how to play. But they're being paid millions of dollars as first-round draft picks, so they have to play. Now, Zion Williamson's doing okay. But there are a lot of guys who come into the league who aren't ready for it. And also, I don't know about any of you, but as a fan, I have trouble getting attached to kids who I know are going to be gone by Easter every year. I'm a Duke grad, and Mike Krzyzewski's a friend. When they lost to Michigan State last year, it didn't really bother me. You know, the three kids who were the heart and soul of the team were all leaving, and there'd be three new kids the next year. So overall, I think it's bad, but it's been good for the mid-majors.
Quick aside, Dickie Weiss was my sports editor at the Temple News in 1969.
That's why you didn't become a sports writer?
That's why I became a teacher, yes. What is your final four, and I know the Palestra is the champion, of venues for college basketball?
Palestra's one, Cameron is two, Allen Fieldhouse is three, and the Kennel at Gonzaga is four. That's my Mount Rushmore. Hinkle's up there, but they've renovated it so much that it doesn't have this. To me, it doesn't have the same feel that it had when I first went. I first went to Hinkle in 1986 when I was doing Season on the Brink, and it hadn't become iconic to most people in college basketball at that point. It was that was the year they filmed Hoosiers, and for some reason they didn't hire me as an extra. I don't know why. Assist.
So
right
you're
there.
Covering Villanova in 1985 as yes. a reporter. And so you're supposed to be impartial, but as a sports fan, you must be freaking out. How do you walk that tightrope?
It's a very good question. And I taught for several years. And my first question to my class each year was, give me the definition of an objective reporter. And I get all these various answers. And I say, no, there's no such thing. None of us are objective. We all have biases. And we can have biases because, you know, Dave Anderson, the great Pulitzer Prize winning sports writer from the New York Times, told me when I was a very young reporter, you're always allowed to root for yourself. It's the first rule of sports writing. I remember during the Butler-Duke National Championship game in 2010, 30 seconds left, Duke's up one, Butler's got the ball, and Gene Smith, who's the athletic director at Ohio State, was sitting right next to me. And he says, look, you're a Duke grad, you're friends with Krzyzewski, but you're the ultimate defender of the underdog. What do you want to see happen here? And I said, Gene, it's 11:37 at night. I want to see somebody win this blanking game in regulation. But what you have to do is be aware that you have biases. Understand, like, I don't like Tiger Woods. I just think he treats people badly. And the quote, new Tiger Woods, might be a little better, but not so much. But for me not to acknowledge, in my opinion, he's the greatest player of all time. Due respect to Jack Nicklaus. But when he dominated the way he dominated, nobody, including Jack Nicklaus, ever dominated that way. So you have to separate. You have to acknowledge greatness when you see it, even if you don't like the person. And you have to acknowledge mistakes when you see them, even if you do like the person. So that's the way I do it.
So what's your thoughts on Herbie McGee at Philly
Textile? King.
He's a gem. So I just wanted to know what you thought.
He's a gem, to put it mildly. I was there the night he went past Bob Knight on the all-time wins list. He's still going strong. He went past 1,100. He's the only guy who's coached at three different schools without ever moving. But gem is a good word. He's a great coach. He was a great player. I didn't see him. I'm not that old. But he's another reason why I love coming to Philadelphia. Let's put it that way. He really is. I love going to see his teams play when I get a chance.
Do you have any feeling about who might succeed Coach K?
You know, that changes. Because I first asked him that question 10 years ago. I said, so whenever you quit, who's going to take over for you? And he goes, well, maybe Wojo, who was on the staff at the time, maybe Chris Collins. Maybe Johnny Dawkins. He didn't say Amaker because I don't think Amaker's leaving Harvard. He loves it there. And I said, well, what about someone like Brad Stevens? What about someone like Shaka Smart? Really good young coaches. And he said, they are great young coaches. He said, but it has to be someone who understands the culture. And I said, well, what did you understand about the culture when you got here? He said, I created the blanking culture. I couldn't argue. I would add Jeff Capel to that list. I think Mike would very much like it if it's the right thing to do to be succeeded by an African-American. I think he thinks that's important for a place like Duke, who had so many great African-American players. Maybe time to have an African-American coach. Wow. So, thank you. Yes, ma'am. Right there. The lady from Farmington.
You got it. Actually, you spoke at my high school graduation in 2003. Do you remember
where Radford?
You were? No, BCC.
Oh, high school. Yes,
high school,
BCC, yeah.
So anyway, thanks for being here. My question is actually much the same. So I'm a North Carolina grad. Curious who your next like four or five really top-tier coaches are that are going to take over a lot of these big jobs from guys who retire soon.
Well, so a few years ago, I would have had Shaka Smart very high on the list. Is that one of my kids? They're going to get in the tournament, I think, at Texas this year, but his job was actually in jeopardy earlier this year, which shocks me because I think he's a very good coach. I think Duke has more candidates, guys who've been head coaches, to succeed Mike than Carolina has as head coaches to succeed Roy. It'll be interesting. Do they stay on the bench? Do they hire Hubert Davis, who's right there. Again, school's never had an African-American basketball coach. Maybe it's time. And Dean Smith, as you know, was one of the leaders in terms of civil rights, actually helped desegregate restaurants in Chapel Hill in 1958 as an assistant coach, one of the many reasons why I admire him so much. But there are a lot of really, one of the things I learned doing this book, people always say, what surprised you? And one of the things that surprised me, even though I kind of knew it, was how good these teams are and how good some of these coaches are. There's a guy named John Becker at Vermont who can coach with anybody. I mean, he's as good a coach as Ryan Odom's going to be a star. Ryan Odom's going to get a big job sometime pretty soon, Dave Odom's son. You go around the country. If I were one of those power programs and my longtime coach was stepping down, I would look first at mid-major stars, unless there's somebody sitting right on the bench who you want to promote. Kyle Keller, the guy at Stephen F. Austin. I mean, he's only averaged like 27 wins a year. And I just interviewed a guy named Chris Jans today, who's the coach at New Mexico State. He's been a head coach for 11 seasons, 7 junior college, 4 Division I, never won less, fewer than 21 games. So I'd say he can coach. So those are just, I'm sure if you ask me half an hour from now, I'll give you 5 different names.
A quick comment, then a question. First, as a 1976 graduate of Duke University, I want to thank you for increasing the perceived value of my diploma.
I'm not sure about that. You didn't see my grades.
No. The perceived value.
Well said.
The question is, as a writer, my guess is you have many ideas for potential next books. Has an audience member ever just said the right thing to spark your focus in the direction you'd already been heading?
To spark the focus I'm already heading, or to give me an idea?
Both.
Give me an idea, no. I got a call today from an agent who said, hey, how would you like to write my book? And I said, no, thanks, for calling. There are times, however, like I did a speaking thing promoting this book on Monday in Washington at the same bookstore where I did my very first book signing, actually, Politics and Prose, great independent store, D.C. person, right? And people ask me frequently, what's your next book? And the next book I'm working on right now is on race and sports, because I think it is the elephant in the room in our society, not just in sports. I mean, just look at the reaction and the polarization during the anthem protests a couple of years ago. And there's a lot more to that story than people know. But several people came up to me afterwards and said, that's a great idea. We're really glad you're doing it. None of them were NFL general managers who didn't draft Lamar Jackson, just for the record. So yes, people have encouraged me.
COVID-19, the other day, a NCAA players group said they want to play in an empty arena for the tournament. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think any of us really knows, other than Mike Pence, of course, what's going on. I'm not a doctor. I didn't stay in a Holiday Inn Express last night. So I just don't know. I mean, I think it'd be a shame if they had to do that. But they would hold the tournament because they ain't giving back the TV bucks, I promise you that. So the games will be played. Whether there'll be people in the arena, we'll have to see.
I was a freshman at University of Arizona in 2004. We were up 15 at the under 4 and lost to Illinois to go to the Final Four.
I remember that,
Is there a more brutal loss in NCAA history? Tournament history.
Well, it depends. It depends on your point of view.
It's been 15 years, yeah.
In 2001, Maryland was up 22 on Duke, who they hate, with 5 minutes left in the first half. And I was sitting with the sports editor of the Washington Post, George Solomon, whose knowledge of basketball is slightly less than my knowledge of fashion. And during the timeout, the Maryland fans are dancing in the aisles, literally. And I pointed at them and I said, you see those people over there? About 90 minutes from now, they're going to be so pissed off they won't be able to see straight. And he goes, what are you talking about? They're winning by 22. I said, you don't think Duke's going to make this a game? You think they're just going to go away? And sure enough, they cut it to 11 at halftime. Krzyzewski made a couple very smart adjustments because in spite of what Maryland people think he's a pretty good coach. He doesn't just win because of the refs. And Duke won by 11. So that was, from the Maryland standpoint, pretty brutal. But yours is a good example, though. Yours would be right up there on the list. So I got to take this gentleman, Andy. I'm sorry. Yes, I can do it very quickly. I'm very glad he went back. Bob Knight went back. People may not have heard. Went back to Indiana after 20 years away since he got fired. Bob spent the last 10 years trying to get the last word in on Miles Brand, the president who fired him, who died in 2009. And I'm not even joking when I say that. But I'm glad he's not well. His health isn't good. I think that's part of the reason he went back. I'm glad he went back and got cheered one last time, because in spite of many really bad things that he's done in his life, he deserved those cheers. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.